You may have a hard time recognizing Hurricane Carter nowadays. Not that he looks that much older or any less trim than he did in his prime when he was a top contender for the middleweight boxing championship 35 years ago. The first thing you notice now is the full head of hair. When he was fighting in the 60s and throughout his many years in prison, he shaved his head way before Michael Jordan made it the chic athletic style. Suddenly, he is in the public eye again, the subject of two books and a major Hollywood film. James S. Hirsch has written one of those books, the authorized biography from Houghton Mifflin called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, and it brings Mr. Hirsch and Reuben Hurricane Carter to New York & Company today. Welcome you both to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Reuben, despite your exoneration 15 years ago for the triple homicide convictions you spent so many years in prison for, there are still some people who maintain that you were guilty. I was surprised to read in the Daily News the comments of a man named Richard Noyox, the son of one of the men who was killed, and he said, "They should write another movie about what really happened. Carter is not a nice guy, and he's not innocent. He's getting away with murder." So not everyone agrees with the judge who freed you.
Of course, we will have those kinds of opinions. Based upon nothing more than people's imaginations and people's facts. It's something like, and I don't want to put these two things, these two instances together, but I think simply to give an example, I will use the O.J. Simpson's case, for example. And everybody believes that although he was adjudicated in court, went to trial, and we saw it on television every day, those who wanted to see it, and the jury came back with a not guilty verdict, everybody still believed that O.J. Simpson was guilty, that he committed this crime.
So why can't the reverse happen?
Yeah, you see why he committed this crime. Although nobody saw the actual crime take place, because if anybody saw the crime take place, they would either have been called to court for the prosecutor or called to court for the defense. And since they were not called to court for the defense, nobody knows anything about what has gone on.
But in this case, there were people who saw.
But I think when I was researching the book, and to this day, many people have come up to me and not only asked the question, well, is he innocent or guilty, but also have said to me, just as you read, well, I think Reuben is guilty. And I say, well, why do you think that? And they said, well, I saw Reuben box in Madison Square Garden in 1963, and he looked like a killer. Then I followed the case in the newspapers. The fact is that unlike the 1990s, where high-profile murder cases such as O.J. and JonBenet are thoroughly dissected on cable TV and the Internet and elsewhere, back then, in the 60s and 70s, very few people knew the facts of Reuben's case because the media culture did not exist. In the court of public opinion, Reuben has always faced not so much the weight of evidence, but the burden of perception. He looked like a killer, therefore he was a killer.
Well, actually, Reuben wasn't the only person convicted of the fatal shootings of the two men and women in a bar and grill in Paterson, New Jersey, in June 1966. John Artis was a co-defendant.
Yes.
Who was he?
John Artis was a young teenager, 19 years old. He graduated from high school, was on his way to college with a scholarship for football and track, had never been in trouble with the police before, was a church-going person, was brought up in a very strong family life, and John Artis was on his way to developing his life and acquiring his dreams. When June 17th, 1966, he asked me for a ride home that evening, since I was going his way. And while we were stopped at a red light, then the police stopped us and brought us to the police station and brought us to the hospital and give us lie detector tests, held us for 17 hours, and we were released.
That's all because you were in a white car, and the getaway car was a white car. But you are a lot shorter than John Artis. You're not the tallest man I've ever met. And didn't the eyewitness say the two men were pretty much of equal height?
Oh, actually, there were three eyewitnesses that gave descriptions of the killers that were contrary to the descriptions of Reuben and John Artis. And the chief investigator of the crime testified in a grand jury 2 weeks after the murders and said that neither John nor Reuben matched the descriptions from the eyewitnesses.
And as you said, you were given a lie detector test.
Yes.
The police said you weren't suspects.
Yes.
And then you even testified before a grand jury. Yes. You were cleared.
And was exonerated.
And then you wound up being arrested and convicted.
And then 4 months later, with the help of two petty criminals who were paid $10,000 reward for their perjured testimony and leniency for the crimes that they had committed prior to this and after this, which would have put them in prison for 90 years and then put them on the witness protection program. So just for their perjured testimony, no weapons were ever found, no fingerprints, no paraffin tests were ever taken. Just absolutely no evidence at all.
And based upon these two eyewitnesses,
Alfred Bellow being the key one.
Alfred Bellow as well as Arthur Dexter Bradley. They convicted Reuben and John, but I think what's important to remember is the tenor of the times. In the 1960s in Patterson and elsewhere, racial tensions were very high. Patterson was experiencing white flight. There had been a race riot in 1964, and the city fathers, the white city fathers, feared that they were losing control of the city. And so you had this crime where two black men walked into a bar and shot four white people. They had to find the killers. And Reuben at that time was the most feared man in Patterson, and that brought them to Reuben.
But juries are usually very suspicious of the testimony of criminals.
No, they're not.
They're not?
No, they're not. No, sir. That's a misperception. That's a popular misperception.
That's what we learn in the movie.
Yeah. You won't learn that in this movie.
Well, you will.
No, it's a popular misperception. I'm sorry for cutting you off, but it's a popular misperception. I work in this area. I'm the executive director of the International Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, based in Canada, Great Britain, and the United States. And we find throughout our work that the common perception of everybody is if you're in jail, you're guilty. And if you're in jail, everybody in prison says they're innocent, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is wrong because there is no place for innocence in prison. If you claim to be innocent in prison, it means no chances for parole. It means you can't partake of the prison system. It means that you're not showing any remorse. It means that you can't come to grips with the crime that you did.
The whole thing is about rehabilitation.
It's all about that. And people's perceptions, their erroneous perceptions, are perhaps the very thing that permits these wrongful convictions to take place.
Now, did you have good representation? Was your attorney good?
Oh, that was one of the things that saved my life.
The first
Raymond
time.
A. Brown, yes. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest attorneys on the face of the earth. He helped to save our lives.
Because the prosecutor was calling for the death penalty.
The death penalty was there. And this was a death penalty case, if ever there was one. Four people being shot by two people for no reason at all. If ever there was a death penalty case, this was it.
So do you think that you'd be here today if they'd sentenced you to death?
Of course not. We'd have been killed. And at the same time, if John Artis would have given up, given in, given out to the authorities, I would have been killed. Because for the 15 years that John Artis spent in prison as an innocent man, each year he was taken out of prison and offered a deal that if he would give an incriminating statement against me, because that's all they wanted, it was me, that he would go home that very day and his life would continue. John Artis said, "My parents didn't teach me to lie. They taught me to tell the truth."
He's become the all but forgotten man in this story, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's true.
Because he's really heroic in all of this. He lost 15 years of his life,
right?
Simply because he wasn't willing to say, "Yeah, Reuben did it. Let me out of here."
He also developed a circulatory disorder in prison, and he's had several fingers and toes amputated. And but to this day, he, as Reuben said, he has never swayed from his
John Artis is my hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also had he had the problem with his circulation.
Yes.
You lost you had an eye damaged when you were in prison.
I had my I lost sight in my right eye, because of a botched prison operation, a so-called detached retina. Shortly after my incarceration, when I was in solitary confinement, they took me out of solitary confinement, took me to the to the hospital in the prison, which is not really a hospital. And the doctor told me that I had a detached retina, the beginnings of a detached retina, and if I didn't have an operation, I would go blind. So, of course, he's a figure of authority, and he said that if I didn't have the operation, I would go blind. I didn't want to go blind, so I submitted to the operation.
And then they made you go blind.
And it made me go blind. But, see, life is an attitude. And we got to have an attitude in order to deal with life. If I would say that I lost my sight, that's the wrong attitude, because then that would justify my being angry and bitter because my career was over. My eyesight is gone. But rather than losing my eye, I gain the ability to have one eye that sees outwardly and another eye that sees inwardly.
Well, we'll talk about that bitterness and some other things and how you dealt with prison. After we take a little break here, my guests are Reuben Hurricane Carter, the subject of a new book called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter, written by James S. Hirsch, who is a former staff writer for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Stay with us. We're back with James S. Hirsch. He's written a book called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And with us is also the subject of the book, Hurricane Carter. Reuben, you just said about Jim Hirsch, this man knows more about me than I know about myself. You wrote an autobiography at one point. Was that less than truthful?
No, that was absolutely truth.
That was the
16th
round.
Bitter truth. That was the 16th round. And that was written primarily because our story was not told in court. Courts are not the places to reveal the truth.
And nowadays, you probably would have gotten a lot more coverage of the trial because newspapers are different. You were, Jim, working for newspapers at the time of this change. Why do you think it got so little coverage, even though he was a celebrity. He was earning six figures
right.
as a boxer at a time when that was a lot of money.
The information age hadn't arrived yet. This was before Court TV, before Geraldo, before a lot of PBS radio stations. Had this case taken place now, it would have captured the imagination of the country. But although back in the 70s, you know, Reuben did become a household name when Bob Dylan and Muhammad Ali and others rallied to his support. Dylan's song about Reuben did make Reuben into a national and even an international figure.
Had you been a Bob Dylan fan before then?
not really, although I like all kinds of music. I really like country and western music very much.
That's because you were in prison. We understand. also because you like to ride horses. One of the reasons you became a suspect is because you were considered a difficult character in Paterson, New Jersey, right?
No question.
You had flashy clothes and a fancy car. You used to ride around on a horse that you owned. You were seen socializing with white women. Some people have described what happened to you as a kind of white reaction to the civil rights movement. But Paterson is not in Mississippi. It's in New Jersey.
No, geography doesn't mean anything. Geography doesn't mean that. The only thing that's different between Mississippi and Paterson is Mississippi is spelled with an M and Paterson with a P. But it's the same thing.
You've said you can't go back there.
Beg your pardon?
You've said you can't go back there? Have you gone back
there? No. There's nothing in Paterson, New Jersey that I wish to see, such as the comments from Fred Noyak's son.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment of another victim's son, which was exposed on A&E program, the Bill Curtis show, where he said that one of the victim's grandson said, quote, Carter and Artis should be shot down, should be hunted down and shot.
And it's not just the relatives of the victims. More importantly, it's the law enforcement authorities. The sheriff of Passaic County, who was a police officer in Paterson on the night of the crime, was quoted in a local newspaper a year and a half ago saying that he wished that he had thrown the switch on Reuben Carter. And this is the most powerful law enforcement official in the county. So Reuben's reticence to return to Patterson is understandable.
But you had a history of violence, didn't you?
I had a history of self-protection.
Well, you came from a good middle-class family, yeah. You rejected the values that they had represented?
No, it's not a rejection. It's just that when I, from a little boy, 6 years old, going to school, when the children all came out of the house and turned to the left and went up the street to the school, I just could not turn to the left and follow the crowd. I turned to the right and went around the corner. And it has been that way all my life. I could never follow the crowd. But I want to get back to something that you mentioned earlier that we didn't completely exonerate. And that is the fact of the public's perception about my case or anything. The fact of the matter is that this crime took, and it was a crime. It was anytime people lose their lives under such circumstances, it is a crime.
You're just saying you're
against,
not the one who did it.
Yeah. It's a crime against humanity and it's a crime against life itself. And I would not do that. But anyway, there is not one person who was around 35 years in the prosecutor's office or anywhere in the city of Patterson or on this earth who's around today that was around then. And therefore, any perception or protection of this case comes from those who do not know, because those who do know are gone. And it's the same thing about
all the cops are retired or dead?
Gone. Mm-hmm. They're gone. Moved up, been promoted, are judges, are Supreme Court justices and things like that. They moved up the rank. So nobody there knows anything about it. And small wonder, therefore, that very few people know about the case. Even the victims' families, and I have a great deal of empathy for them, mm-hmm. empathy well, for their problem.
Part of your problem is that when you were 11 years old, you stabbed somebody and you were sent to reform school.
Yes,
you say he was molesting you?
Oh no, he wasn't molesting me. He was getting ready to throw me off a 90-foot cliff into the Passaic Waterfalls. That's what he's doing. But what
so how
it was
come
found
you wound up
out,
going to jail? I would have thought that was self-defense.
Because this person was a pillar of the community. Except this person was also a predator upon young children who could not swim in the swimming pools of the city because the swimming pools were segregated. And therefore, the black people had to swim in the rivers and in the subholes around the city. And this man knew that young children came to this place we call Tubbs to swim, and we swam naked. Mm-hmm. And this man used to use this place as his feeding ground.
Have you followed this part of the story, Jim?
Yes. Yeah, that's
you found the guy?
No. No, I didn't
find him. You know who he is?
His name has been reported before, but it's not worth repeating.
There's no sense in even regurgitating.
Well, the only reason is that you did go to reform school for 10 years, and you escaped.
Yes.
Wound up going to the Army as part of your escape, and that became a factor in your story with
the
law.
The reason why it became a factor, because for the first 18 years of my life, I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. I stuttered badly, and couldn't make sense out of anything. And when I went into the military, I met an angel. I've been surrounded by angels all my life. I met an angel, Ali Hassan, who from the Sudan, who helped me to understand myself, who helped me to channel my energies in positive directions.
And so you became a boxer.
So I became a prize fighter.
But the reason it also played a factor later is when you came out of the Army, here you are, a prize fighter, somebody who has a nice career ahead of him. You were arrested again, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes.
For escaping from the reform school.
For escaping. When I returned from the military.
So you had a prison record.
Yes. And when I returned from the military, I was the number one, I was the light welterweight champion of Europe for 2 years running. And when I returned to Patterson, back to Patterson, I was arrested because I had escaped from Janesburg. You see, so I'm back in prison again.
You
now,
that
if
that
I go,
passed.
You know, to answer your question as to why I will not go back to Patterson, it seems to me that every time I go back to Patterson, I end up in jail.
Well, you when you were sent to jail after the first conviction, you were uncooperative because you said that you didn't want to be treated like a typical inmate.
No. That was in 1967 when I went.
Yeah, that's what he's referring to.
I'm jumping ahead now.
Okay. No, I would not obey the prison because I was not a criminal. Why would I become a good inmate, a good prisoner, if I wasn't a bad civilian? Mm-hmm. So to me, it was ludicrous for me to come into any kind of agreement with the prison system at all.
But they have a system of rewards and punishments, and you're punished if you're not exhibiting good behavior.
Reuben completely turned the traditional relationship between prison and inmate on its head. As you say, normally inmates are able to win their freedom by some combination of contrition, rehabilitation, and time served. You then apply to parole and you get released. Reuben did not want to go that route because that would imply that he was guilty of the crime, that he was being paroled for good behavior. The only way Reuben wanted to win his freedom was through the court system, showing through the court system that he was wrongfully convicted.
Mm. You wouldn't even wear prison clothes.
No, I wouldn't eat the prison food. I wouldn't have breathed the prison air if I could have done so and yet remained alive. You see, I come from a very strong, proud family of Carters. You know, we don't take lightly to people imposing impositions of guilt upon us and we not fight back.
Is that how you maintain your sanity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it was because...
Because there you are in prison feeling unjust... Well, you were unjustly convicted of a crime and sentenced to 3 life terms.
That's
you're facing never getting out.
The reason he was able to persevere and survive was simply because he had to maintain his innocence. If Reuben died in prison, and many prisoners do perish there, mm-hmm. If Reuben died, he died a triple murderer. After the second conviction, a racist triple murderer, condemned forever by history. So that was what kept Reuben motivated not to give up.
What happened to your marriage?
My marriage was destroyed just as prison destroyed everything else.
Your wife divorced you while
you're
in prison.
I know. I divorced my wife because she shouldn't be in prison. Mm-hmm. And since I was in prison, that means that she was in prison and my daughter was in prison. I had to release them.
Some prison inmates cut themselves off from the people outside because it hurts too much to think about their situation.
Well, prisoners don't necessarily cut people, their family off from them, but rather the prison cuts the cuts them off from their family.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about when Reuben was in prison, you know, even though he knew he was innocent, when his family or other friends would come to visit him, he felt shame and humiliation. I mean, there's no way to avoid that feeling of letting people down, again, of humiliation, and eventually it just became too painful for Reuben to interact with those who loved him.
And then in 1974, Reuben, you filed a federal suit against the state of New Jersey for transferring you to a psychiatric hospital. Isn't it better to be in a hospital than in a prison?
Not in this psychiatric hospital. This psychiatric hospital that we were transferred to, Thomas Trantino and myself, was called the Vroom... The room building
in the hospital for the
in the hospital for the criminally insane, and this is where they sent their incorrigible prisoners to destroy them, to lose them in the system. The people that are abandoned in this place are like Pelican Bay. Did you see the thing about Pelican Bay? Well, the Vroom building in Trenton, New Jersey is exactly like Pelican Bay. It is the most horrific place that you could ever be. And if the people knew it, if newspaper people knew what was going on there, and if they read about it, the public would tear that place down.
And eventually you won that case, but it was years and years later.
Yes.
But let me tell people who my guests are. Reuben Hurricane Carter, he is the subject of a couple of books that have just been out. We're talking about the one that's gotten the best reviews, the one written by James S. Hirsch called Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Of course, there is a movie in which I don't know whether it was always your lifetime dream to have Denzel Washington play you, but I think there are an awful lot of people out there who that would be the fulfillment of a whole life.
Of course. But, it could not have been a lifetime dream because Denzel wasn't born. Yeah. No, but to have Denzel Washington, I mean, this person. This
one of the great actors of the world.
One of the great actors of the whole world. And good looking to boot. Play me. To see Denzel Washington on that screen, man, I didn't know how good looking I was. Well, I tell you.
You're listening to Radio New York, AMA 20 WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm curious about the bald head. Why did you shave your hair?
Well, see, that was my persona. I wanted to be a prize fighter. Just like the wrestling in those days, Golden Boy and all those people, I wanted to be a prize fighter. So therefore, I had to create a persona. I had to create something that made me stand out. Mm-hmm. So I shaved my head off as a 17-year-old. I shaved my head off. I shaved my hair off. And when I was able to grow a mustache and a beard, I let it grow. So I developed that persona. The problem with that persona is that I began to take that persona on myself and thought that it was me.
You thought you were the meanest guy
in
the world.
Yeah, I was so mean, I scared myself, you know? So it was in prison when I had to come to terms, in solitary confinement, when I had to come to terms with this persona, with this personality, with this bald-headed, mean, bearded prize fighter. I had to come to grips with that and realize that that was not me at all.
Well, let's get back to our story. So you have sued to not go into the psychiatric ward. And then in March of 1976, the New Jersey Supreme Court unanimously overturned your convictions. Mm-hmm. On what grounds?
Well, on the grounds that the state had indeed withheld information that it made promises to Bellow and Bradley, the state's two key eyewitnesses, in exchange for their testimony. And this was what Rubin and his lawyers had always claimed from the beginning, that this was perjured testimony in exchange for some sort of financial reward or something like this. And this finally came out when a tape was discovered. And
didn't the two of them say that they had actually perjured their testimony?
Yes. Well, in fact, that's true. Both of them acknowledged that they had perjured their testimony. But the trial judge reviewed the appeal of those recantations and determined that that did not constitute overturning the conviction. I mean, this was a problem that Rubin repeatedly faced.
Well, but isn't it weird that the trial judge is always asked to review what his own conduct is?
Exactly,
law.
Because
that's
for him, for the trial judge to overturn something in his own courtroom would be to make a mockery of the very trial that he oversaw, but that was the law.
So there was a new trial.
Right.
And the two of you and John Artis were released on bail.
Yes.
But the second trial wasn't a repeat of the first.
No, it was more horrendous than the first. Yeah,
though you had great attorneys here as well.
Yeah, well, Myron Beldock and Leon Friedman and Lou Steele, absolutely.
The biggest difference in the second trial was that the prosecutors asserted a motive for the first time. There was no motive in the first trial. But in the second trial, the prosecutor said that Rubin committed this crime to exact revenge for a murder that occurred in Patterson earlier that evening, a murder in which a white man walked into a bar and shot a black man. And the prosecutor said Rubin and John shot these white people to avenge that.
A matter of racial revenge.
Racial hatred. And the prosecutors told the jurors that even though that other blacks in Patterson, not Rubin and John, but other blacks in Patterson were angry and were calling for revenge on that night. And the jurors could infer that if other blacks were angry, so were John and Rubin.
But you had never even made a statement that suggested that you were angry about it. Did you even know about the murder?
Nor was there any connection. I didn't know anything.
Well, wouldn't most
that.
Judges disallow a prosecution that followed that line?
Well, Rubin's lawyers protested vehemently. In fact, one of the lawyers was held in contempt because of Louis Steele was held in contempt because his protests were increasingly strident. But because the problem was that in Rubin's view and the lawyer's view, this was the worst type of racial profiling, if you will. It wasn't called it back then. But if a group of blacks act one way, then you can assume that all blacks act that way.
There's a kind of a tribalism.
That blacks behave not as individuals but as a group. And ultimately, many years later, it was that very racial revenge theory that was used to overturn the conviction by a federal judge.
But why wasn't that done earlier? I know there were many appeals filed. Other courts find racial revenge permissible?
It's tough to overturn a jury conviction.
The New Jersey Supreme Court rejected an appeal for a new trial in 1982.
By a very close 4-3 decision. Yeah. Although the dissent of that decision was also used by the federal judge who ultimately overturned the conviction. The fact is it's much easier to rubber stamp a verdict than to overturn it. And frankly, Rubin's own perception that people thought he was a racist triple murderer at that time. People that weren't familiar with the case. All those things
as
hurt
well,
Rubin.
As well, Jim, thanks for letting me get in here. As well as...
It's fun to sit and listen to two people talk about you.
As well as people were seeing me on television every Friday night or so, coming in there with a black robe on, looking like a monk, you know what I mean, and bearded and muscled down to the hilt. And they saw me as a killer inside the ring. And then when I began to protest social issues and telling people to defend themselves, then they transferred that ring image to the social image and said, if he's a killer in the ring, then he must be a killer.
But you weren't a killer in the ring. You defeated a guy who was a killer in the ring, Emil Griffin.
Yeah.
He unfortunately did kill Benny Perrette, didn't
he? Yes, he did. That was very
And then you defeated him on your way up. You were a welterweight and then you...
I was middleweight and Emil was the welterweight champ and he wanted to move up into the welterweight division. I was the top-ranking contender, so he had to come through me.
And he didn't.
And he didn't.
You say that going back to prison in some ways was a good thing.
I say that
you weren't
gingerly.
Ready to come out?
No, I say that gingerly. I say that with a great deal of explanation of which we don't have time to do. Mm. But I will say that when we were released in 1966 on bail, which means that our imprisonment was simply enlarged, when we were released, we were released without money, without a job, immediately, and we had nothing. And so we had to get right out of prison and get on a fast track to try to make a living for my family, to support my wife.
You couldn't go back to boxing.
To support my children. I couldn't go back to boxing. I'm blind in one eye
now. And you're 39 years old.
Yeah, I'm 39 years old. So I had to try to make a living. And trying to make that living just kept me running and running until when we were convicted, it almost felt like a relief.
And, the transition from imprisonment to freedom is extremely difficult for anyone because prison, you lose all of your independence. You're a ward of the state. Everything is dictated to you. So the pressures...
When you wake up, when you go to eat, everything.
Exactly. When you move, where you move. And so the pressures that Rubin faced are common to all inmates, so that prison is a kind of sanctuary because you don't have to worry.
And you did use it as such. You self-educated.
Oh, yeah.
You started reading other kinds of things. Most people read law books. You'd done that, but now you were reading philosophy
and
religion.
I'm researching religions. I'm researching cultures. I'm trying to get to the root of everything. That what did these things mean in their earliest usage? What did they mean? You know, and when you try to go back to the foundation, to the source of something, and trying to escape the prison by finding something above the law, well, you may stumble upon the universal prison. The universal prison. And when you struggle to get out of the universal prison, then everything on earth is nullified.
So there's a certain enlightenment factor. I mean, nobody wants to stay in prison for 20 years to become enlightened, but who knows what you would have been if you hadn't.
Rubens described it as he turned his cell into an unnatural laboratory of the human spirit. And day after day, week after week, he studied these books by philosophers and historians and religious gurus to try to help him make sense of his own life, and that played a big role.
Now, the film that was released recently with Denzel Washington puts the blame for your legal problems on the actions of one rogue cop.
No.
A whose real name is Vincent DeSimone. No, they didn't do
no,
that?
No.
They show this guy is obsessed with you.
Yeah, but well, he was. Mm-hmm. But this is like a composite of all the Patterson.
Yeah, but it was most of the police department and most of the judiciary. I think that's an important point. For whatever reason, they colluded.
The filmmakers were in a position where they had to tell the story in a two-hour time period, and so that's what they had to do. I think people who see the film probably will understand that. And the advantage of writing a book is you can tell the story in more depth and detail.
But what's really interesting, and one of the things that gets lost in all of this, is that after Judge Sarokin freed you and said to the New Jersey judiciary, "Leave this guy alone. He's been through enough." They continued to pursue the case. They took it twice to the U.S. Court of Appeals and even to the Supreme Court. It dragged on for two and a half or three more years.
And stake was not simply the innocence or guilt of the defendants, but the reputations of those who made the arrest, who sought the indictment, who won the convictions. And in Ruben's case, you know, his freedom represented an embarrassment to literally dozens of people who were involved.
And
in
they
that
drew
case.
It out and made it even more embarrassing. Yes. You live in Toronto now, Ruben?
Yes, I do.
You moved there originally because you joined a Canadian commune that helped to get you out.
That's true.
And they played an important role in maintaining your sanity during the rougher years.
They made an important contribution in not maintaining my sanity. They had nothing to do with that.
Well, didn't they bring you nice goodies and stuff like that?
Yes, that's maintaining my life, not my sanity.
I mean, you even had a carpet in your room.
You know, When this group of people who helped Lesra Martin, this illiterate child, become educated, and today Lesra Martin has an honors BA from the University of Toronto, a master's degree from Dalhousie in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and 2 years ago he graduated from law school, and today he is a crowned attorney in Kamloops, British Columbia.
Another Brooklyn guy and a Patterson guy, both
that
living in Toronto.
That is absolutely wonderful.
You see, you've disassociated yourself from that group now, but do you still bump into them around Toronto?
Yes. As a matter of fact, just on the 27th of December, we had a screening in Toronto, and all of the Canadians, there were 13 of us at the time, all of the Canadians were present, and I had the opportunity to thank them for all that they've done, their commitment, and it was good. But you see, we all move on in life. We're not stationary ever, because this universe consists of perpetual change, constant change. We need to change. So we move on in our lives. We love our mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, but we don't live with them for the rest of our lives.
So does that mean that you and James Hirsch will stop talking to each other after this book deal?
Probably.
Well, you heard it here first.
I'll send him a Christmas card, and hopefully he'll open it.
No, but James has a cherubic daughter, Amanda, who looks just like a little cherubic angel. And we will never be apart, because that's my girlfriend.
Your wife is in the other room. Listening.
My wife understands that.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. Ruben Hurricane Carter, do you still use the name Hurricane at all?
You can call me anything, just as long as you send me to the bank.
Call me to dinner.
Yes.
Ruben Hurricane Carter, the subject of James S. Hirsch's book, Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Ruben Carter. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's been a great pleasure.
And I just might just suggest, before you do that, read the book and then go see the movie.